happy to have you listening, or maybe some of you will listen afterwards and hear a recording of this message. But it's very nice to know other people are out there. But we're enjoying each other's company here, too, in Celebration, Florida. Celebration, Florida is a great place to be this time of year. You know, July 4th is coming up. This message is being given the day before July 4th. The country will be 228 years old. July 4th has some personal meaning for me. I was bar mitzvah on July 4th, 1959. My mother was a widow for many years. She finally remarried on July 4th of 1967. And I remember being in southern Mississippi, where my wife's from, on July 4th, 1776. We were celebrating the bicentennial. And at that time, it was the Entebbe rescue. We were celebrating, in effect, two things, the bicentennial and the rescue at Entebbe. We've had some interesting presidents over the years. 70 years ago, we had a colorful president from New England, Calvin Coolidge, and he was known as one who didn't really have a lot to say. There's a story about him that somebody went to a presidential banquet and was sitting there for quite some time, and there was no conversation going on. This person was exasperated, finally shouted at President Coolidge, "I bet my friend $5 I could get three words out of you." And the president said, "You lose." But I don't know if that's a true story, but they'd like to tell that about him. He was actually a lot better, greater president than people think, which is often the case. A lot of underrated presidents. Maybe some have been overrated too, but that's another story. I have a subject to talk about today that I don't remember ever covering before, but it's something that has weighed heavily on me over the years. I call this the Bible and balanced religion. The Bible and balanced religion. You know, each area has its in-speak, its icons, as it were, its heroes and villains, its traditions. Each field, it's each area of life. We have entertainment, we have sports. The field of religion, often very bizarre and weird things seem to be reserved for that field. And that's, of course, very unfortunate. It's so basic. People's relationship with God is the beginning, the foundation of their life. Obviously, to survive physically, you need food, clothing, shelter. But then what's it for? Why are you living? And that's where religion comes in. And for religion to occupy the place that it does, to be looked upon as it is, to be stereotyped the way it is actually a tragedy. And it's one reason why often sound-minded people want to be religious but don't quite know how to do it, because they're often very turned off by the religions that at least they have been exposed to. Now, sometimes they're fortunate enough to find a positive outlet for their beliefs and practices, maybe reaching out beyond their initial environment, they find something. But often, if they remain within a certain social circle, the approach that they find to religion is one that they just can't really ever be comfortable with. So maybe even if they do it, there's still a certain discomfort with it. So I want to get into that today, to talk about that concept of how often religion can be a turnoff if we treat it in an unbalanced way. If we don't treat it as something practical, something that God designed in order to teach us certain lessons, in order to help us to get from point A to point B, you might say, in this life, in order for us to be successful. He didn't design it to be really bizarre and outlandish and peculiar. You know, he designed it to be because it's good for us. It's not something that we're supposed to endure, but something that is actually supposed to be good for us. I want to begin by going to John 17. John 17. And when Jesus Christ was about to finish his human ministry, he was about to face arrest, incarceration, torture, and death. He prayed at length in John 17, and he said this in John 17, verse 4. He said in John 17, 4, "I have glorified you on the earth. I have finished the work which you have given me to do. And now, O Father, glorify me together with yourself, with the glory which I had with you before the world was." So Christ glorified God the Father in his ministry. And so somebody observing Christ would, in effect, have, you know, positive vibes if that person were a sound-minded person. Now, if that person were himself a fanatic and unbalanced, then, of course, Christ would have upset and offended. He was a quote-unquote glutton and a wine bibber, you might say. They said, put it that way, he was accused of that. Maybe I should go to Matthew 11. Sometimes God does send a person who's maybe a little bit of an oddball. You can still, you know, respect the person. You can still respect the person, but nevertheless maybe not identify with them that well. But the normal example that God sends is somebody that you ought to be able to identify with personally. If you go to Matthew 11 and verse 16, Christ says, "But to what shall I liken this generation? It is like children sitting in the marketplaces and calling to their companions and saying, 'We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We mourned to you, and you did not lament.'" In other words, whatever God tries out doesn't seem to satisfy us. Verse 18, "For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon." John was a more austere kind of person. He's the kind of person you could respect, but maybe be a little bit fearful to interact with. So Christ came as a normal, very, you know, balanced type of personality, the type of person who maybe would be elected president of the class or something. "The Son of Man," verse 19, "came eating and drinking, and they say, 'Look, a glutton and a wine bibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.' But wisdom is justified by her children." You know, so Christ was sinless, and yet unbalanced people would have found fault, and yet he was sinless. So, okay, I realize that if a person wants to be wants to have hang-ups or does have hang-ups, then that person perhaps cannot be satisfied. But there are some people who are normal, sound-minded, balanced people, and they ought to be able to identify with and respect somebody of that sort. And Christ did come and glorify his Father with the example that he set. And often, religion is a turnoff, and people, when they hear about it, read about it, observe it, tend to be offended, where they never get around to the core message, the ethical teachings, because they're just so offended by the trappings, the weirdness, and the exotic and strange characteristics of it. Now, it's true that appeals to some people. People seem to need that in religion. They seem to need, emotionally, some of these bizarre trappings. But then, you know, others who are perhaps more practical think of these things and they say, what does this have to do with the purpose of life? You know, what does this have to do with being a better person? I want to give some examples of what this is something very important in Hebraic tradition, is the concept of Chilul Hashem, desecration of the name of God, or what we call in Hebrew being Mechalel Shem Shamayim, desecrating the name of heaven or desecrating God's name. It's a very serious problem, and we find it in a lot of different ways. I want to first go to Leviticus 21. And while we're turning there, let me just say that I knew when I spoke today that I would be stepping on toes, for the reason that I'm going to talk about various religions, and I will tell you that if you dig into any religion, you're going to find what you might call the seamier side. Now, I realize that people can cop out with this. They can say, well, organized religion, I don't want to have anything to do with quote-unquote organized religion, and they can kind of cop out, because it is, in effect, a cop-out. Because, obviously, you live in a city that's got roads and the police officers and the fire department and various institutions so that you can conduct your life smoothly. There is organization in your city, and you work in an economy where there are standards being maintained and laws against fraud and currency, standard currency to trade with and weights and measures and so on. You know, so you economically need organization, and politically you need organization, and on it goes. So when it comes to religion, do as best you can. Copping out is not the answer. Do as best you can. So as I said, some people use the fact that religion has problems to opt out. Well, you know, the human race has problems. So you remember President Carter, when his church had a certain problem with prejudice, he worked to reform the church rather than leave the church. And he said at the time, "I'm not going to leave the human race because there are problems." You know. But anyway, I would like to go to Leviticus 21. But it is true that most religions or many religions, as you dig into them, you know, it's colorful, it's interesting, isn't that fascinating? And then you find out more about it, and it's just horrifying, really. And it's probably just for, it's probably for the best that when you see some of these movies and you see these interesting religious cults, a lot of times they just present them as isn't that cute or isn't that fascinating or interesting, and you don't get into the seamier side because I guess it would just be so negative if you did. And I want to get into some of that today. That's what I'm driving at. I do want to get into some of that today. For example, you know, let's first talk about Buddhism. I'm not down on Buddhism. I'm not down on any of the religions I'm going to talk about necessarily in that sense, you know, specifically like I'm picking on them. But like in Buddhism, I remember watching an account of a Zen Buddhist in Japan, a monk who was preparing himself, I guess, for the next spiritual level. And it's incredible the physical abuse he put himself through, what they expect you to do to your body to attain whatever level it is of spirituality you're supposed to attain. And what does that do to your character to abuse yourself in that way? And the average monk, I remember hearing about the average Thai monk. As far as I know, the average young man in Thailand does volunteer to become a monk as part of his life's experience. Most people don't stay with it, of course. Most Thais then go on to do whatever it is they're going to do. But most Thais become monks for a period of time. And as far as I understand, the monks shave off their hair. I mean, you know, no hair on the head, no eyebrows. No facial hair, no hair, and they don't drink alcohol. They don't eat after a certain time of day. They go to a certain time of day and then stop. They no more eating after a certain meal. Of course, they don't touch females if they're males. Where do these things come from? Where do these restrictions come from? And I understand they have their reasoning behind it. Obviously, people, things are not done without a reason. And I'm sure if a monk came here, he could give me a lot of good reasons why they don't touch women or alcohol or food after a certain time of day or why they shave all their hair. I'm sure they could give me the reasons. But, you know, the average person, just stepping out, and just whatever culture they come from and looking at these things, yeah, when you get used to it, it may be familiar to you and you're used to it and you're okay with it until somebody else says, wait a minute, until somebody questions it. And then I think even a person from within the culture would say, yeah, I guess you're right. I guess, you know, when you really think about it, why do we have to do these things? Why do young men have to go through this and so on? And if you look at Leviticus 21, God told his priests not to do bizarre things, not to mutilate themselves, not to maim themselves, not to make their bodies look strange. In verse 4 of Leviticus 21, I'm going to go to verse 5. They shall not make any bald place on their heads, nor shall they shave the edges of their beards, nor make any cuttings in their flesh. Don't take some bizarre style, and you can say right away, ah, there's a priest. I can tell it's a priest because he's got his beard in a certain configuration or whatever it is. You know, we tend to want to have that in our society. We tend to want to have the clerics looking like clerics. Wow, here's a cleric, you know. Now, it's true that when he's officiating, he has an official type of clothing, and that would be true of judges or people in various walks of life. A baseball player wears a uniform when he's playing baseball. He doesn't have to wear his uniform all the time. When he's out shopping at the mall, he doesn't have to wear his baseball outfit and so on. A judge doesn't leave the bench and go to the mall wearing the robes. And so why should a priest have to always look different, you know, but that's what we seem to want sometimes. But here he says, don't make yourself look, you know, weird. Don't cut yourself. And you might say, well, why would anybody have to be told not to cut himself? Because people somehow think it's religious to mutilate yourself. Isn't that, that's the way it is with religion. You know, religion tends to go off in these areas where people seem to think that God will be more approving of them if they somehow do something to hurt themselves. That somehow God's going to take maybe pity on them. Oh, look what you did to yourself. Now I'll listen to you. That does seem to be the way it is. And another tendency in religion which I found, which seems to be a cross-cultural, many, many religions have this tendency, is that religion somehow, by nature, seems to be a very conservative thing, and in some ways that's good. But a lot of times what they want to conserve are simply old-fashioned ways of doing things. Whether it be in music, whether it be a hairstyle, whether it be in clothing style, that somehow, you know, religious music is the kind that would have been popular in 1910. And people who are religious dress the way maybe more people would have dressed, you know, a generation or two ago. And on it goes. And there are some religions that make a religion out of being old-fashioned. And you know yourself. I mean, when I was a 10-year-old child, my mother took me to Lancaster County in Pennsylvania to look at the Amish people. So, I mean, it's a tourist attraction. But why should religious people be a tourist attraction? I mean, is that how the gospel is to be preached? that people would come and gawk at somebody driving in 1956 in a horse and buggy, and so on. You know, so we do have that concept. And so I guess I've gone from Buddhism now to picking on the Amish. All right, so let me pick on my own ethnic group. I remember I've had some wonderful times in among Hasidic Jews. I remember one time though I went into this area in New York City, and it was kind of different because it was almost like a jungle, and I went into this jungle and I saw all these big chickens everywhere, and they'd been slaughtered, you know, in a kosher way, and they had this big kosher label on them, and I said, where am I? And somebody said, you're in Hasidic Park. I know that was a bad, I'm sorry about that. That Mel Brooks got away with that joke on TV, but I guess I didn't. But anyway, being with Hasidic Jews, I had wonderful times with them. But you know, they have preserved the style of the Eastern European nobility. They are dressing now for the Sabbath the way maybe a very wealthy nobleman in Eastern Europe would have dressed for a special occasion centuries ago. On the Sabbath, they have these long coats and fur hats, and of course they have beards. And yet here they are, maybe in Jerusalem or in Eilat, or in New York City, and they're dressed like a Polish nobleman would have dressed in the 1700s for a special occasion. I remember when I was in Israel digging, one secular Israeli came to me and said, I went down to Eilat and I saw this Hasid there, and it was so hot. He was dressed in this long coat and hat and beard. And I was thinking, you know, what does God expect of people, you know? And so he used that as a way to sort of criticize religion. You know, why should God expect his people to be that way? If you're going to live in a lot where it's over 100 degrees, you have to dress in a long black coat and a big hat and a beard, you know, and so forth. And but often religion does tend to want to preserve, you know, the old-fashioned customs. And as I said, Hasidic Jews now believe that they need to be to remain in the kind of clothing that was worn, you know, many, many years ago. Anyway, to continue on, it says, they shall be holy to their God and not profane the name of their God. For they offer the offerings of the Eternal made by fire and the bread of their God, therefore they shall be holy. So this concept of Chilul Hashem, you know, don't profane the name of God. But if religious people go out of their way to be strange in ways that are not essential, you know, if they decide that because they're religious, they've got to preserve, you know, the fashions of the 1920s or whatever it is, or they've got to use maybe King James language. Quite frankly, a lot of people cling to the King James translation of the Bible. And somehow they almost feel like you're less religious or less spiritual if you quote a contemporary translation. They don't feel, I don't know, somehow as holy if they don't hear that kind of English. But first of all, the Bible wasn't even written in that language, as you know. It was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Aramaic. Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek, I should say, to use the proper order. And it was not written in King James English. And King James English does have an advantage, because we have thou and ye. It probably wasn't pronounced that way back then. It might have been pronounced thou back then. You know, in Spanish we had the pronoun tu for you informal. So maybe it was pronounced thou. We pronounce it thou nowadays because it's foreign to us. We don't use it every day. So we pronounce it thou, and then we have ye. So that's good, because now I know thou is for one person and ye is for plural. But you know, a lot of people who read the King James Bible, they don't even know that. At least if they knew the King James grammar, it might be, you know, worthwhile to read it. But they don't even know that. And they don't know, for example, that thee is singular and you is plural. If you have an object, I would say I love thee if I'm talking to my wife. And then if I'm talking to all my children, I would say I love you. You know, but people don't even know that. And here they're reading the King James Bible. They're not even understanding it anyway. But then when you want to switch to a contemporary translation, in some places it's a big issue. It's the same thing with music. I mean, I understand the old hymns are beautiful, and one thing that struck me recently was about Ronald Reagan. You know, Ronald Reagan he seems to be a greater man in retrospect than even I thought at the time he was president, because as his son pointed out in the eulogy that he gave, he did not wear his religion on his sleeve. He evidently, when he went to church, he knew all the hymns. That's what his pastor said. His pastor, who came from South Africa to this country, said as they finally were going to inter the body, he said that Ronald Reagan could sing without using a hymnal. He knew all the hymns. And that's kind of interesting. Well, obviously, he never boasted about that when he was president, which would have, of course, it wouldn't have been the thing to do, I understand. But you wonder sometimes the way people. Anyway, I won't go into it further. I don't want to get political. But it's interesting, and that's fine. It's nice to have traditional hymns and melodies that you use. But what's the matter with introducing new songs? People are scandalized because this is something that might be a hit right now. I mean, if people heard it and didn't know it was religious, they might even like it. Isn't that good? But we get all bent out of shape over a thing like that, because if it's religious, it's got to be old. Some people think that way. Psalm 98. If you don't mind going back to Psalm 98. Oh, sing to the Eternal a new song. That's what it says. For he has done marvelous things. His right hand and his holy arm have gained him the victory. It doesn't say, continually come up with new things and drop everything else. That's not the point. But it says, sing unto the Eternal a new song. So, you can do that. Now, I was in Leviticus 21, and I went all the way to the Psalms. But if you don't mind, I want to go back to Leviticus 19. I really, to some degree, this seems like ranting. But I'm getting on certain issues, and there are themes involved here. And I think you will find themes involving clothing, involving music, involving various aspects of life where religion seems to favor the bizarre or the old. Anything to sort of put it in a corner and make it less relevant. It seems to me a lot of this makes religion less relevant, or relevant only to certain personality types to whom that appeals. I want to go now to Leviticus 19 and verse 27. You shall not shave around the sides of your head, nor shall you disfigure the edges of your beard. You shall not make any cuttings in your flesh for the dead, nor tattoo any marks on you. I am the Eternal. So, there'd be a tendency, if you're religious, to maybe tattoo, who knows what, a cross on you, maybe? Or maybe tattoo a crescent on you, or something of that nature. But that's not what you should do. You shouldn't be tattooing yourself. And here it talks about shaving around the sides of your head. Very likely in those days, people who worshipped the sun made their hair into like a disc shape. They shaved all around so that their hair on the top became like a skull covering, like a disc, as perhaps part of sun worship. Well, don't do weird things with your hair. Normally, you have hair on the side. Let it be there, and don't disfigure the edges of your beard. Don't show yourself to be in some state of, I don't know, whatever it might be, some emotional state by making yourself look peculiar. It reminds me of an old Sid Caesar story. Carl Reiner says to him, how do you get that haircut of yours? Do you give the barber a special tip? He says, no, I insult him. That's kind of like with religious people. Have you ever noticed that religious people in a lot of religions, they have to have special kinds of haircuts that go along with it? Why can't they just wear their hair like everybody else? They have to have these sort of special haircuts or disfigure themselves sometimes in some ways. And it's interesting that the Hasidic Jews, they've been my latest victim. They take this scripture and turn it into perhaps the very opposite of what it was intended. If you look at Hasidic Jews, they have what they call peyot, or in Yiddish peyis, and they have long, long sideburns that go on and on and on. Side curls they become, and they curl them around their ear in some cases, or they tuck them under their hat, so you don't see how long they really are sometimes. And otherwise their hair is cut very, very short. When I was in rabbinical school, I didn't use a comb. I wouldn't have thought of using a comb. Using a comb was something you didn't do. One of my roommates in the yeshiva, the rabbinical school, was losing his hair. It was thinning. And that happens to some men earlier than others. He was my age, but his hair was thinning a bit. So he did the drastic action of using a comb. He would comb his hair to kind of, stimulate the circulation so that he would keep his hair. I used to tease him about it, not in a wrong way, but just because we were friends. I used to say, ooh, look at you using your comb. Because none of us ever used a comb. None of us ever used a comb. Because we cut our hair so short, we didn't need a comb. But we did make sure that our sideburns were long enough, so that we had proper length sideburns. Now, I didn't have side curls. I didn't have that. I wasn't a Hasid. I was just an ultra-Orthodox Jew, but I wasn't a Hasid. Not every sect went into the side curl approach. The story was that Joseph, when he was in Egypt, took a lot of care with his appearance and began using a comb. And after that, Potiphar's wife went after him. So whenever you tell an Orthodox Jewish man, why don't you use a comb? He says, look what happened to Joseph when he used a comb. And that's the tradition, you know. But it gets worse. I'm going to tell you something that you didn't see. If you saw this movie, Stranger Among Us, and frankly, I didn't see Stranger Among Us because I normally don't go to movies that are that intense. I did see parts of it on TV. It had to do with a murder. It's based on a true story. There was a murder in the diamond industry, which was a shock because the diamond industry are run by families that have close bonds with each other, and a lot of things are done by word of mouth and so on. There's certain families that have gone back generations and generations in the diamond business, and there was a murder in the diamond industry, and it was a real shock at the time. And a lot of ultra-Orthodox Jews are in the diamond industry. In fact, the name Kaplan is very prominent. I wish I worked more closely related to that branch, but the name Kaplan is very prominent in the diamond industry in New York. But you have very ultra-Orthodox Jews in Europe and in Israel and in America that are involved in the diamond industry, and probably in South Africa as well. At least there used to be down there. The point I'm bringing out is that there was a movie called A Stranger Among Us, where a woman has to go underground in the Hasidic community to try to find the murderer. And so you'll learn all about the Hasidic community. But what's nice about that movie is they don't trash it. You know, most movies rag on very religious people, and they tend to be viewed in a very negative stereotype. Unfortunately, those negative stereotypes are out there. That's the point of my talk today. There's just too much of that in reality in religion. There's too much negative stereotypes out there. I watch them on TV every day. I mean, not every day, but as I surf around, I see this or that speaker, and I say, okay, what's he going to be like? And after a few seconds, I almost get ill. And I'm thinking, this represents religion to people, this kind of approach. I see it on these various cable channels. And that's what Hollywood tends to want to use. When they want to talk about religion, they want to take the negative example, and that becomes what they want to use. In this case, instead of ragging on religion, they were very respectful of Hasidic Judaism and even pictured it in a very ideal way. I didn't see the whole movie, but the impression I get is that it was pictured in a very positive way. Well, let me say something about Hasidic Judaism. What happens in Hasidic Judaism, and there are an awful lot of people that practice it, you know, more than you might think. I mean, not that you're going to find them in the streets of Wichita or something, but in New York City, there are a lot of Hasidic communities, and in Israel you have a lot of them, and then here and there you have pockets of them, but there are thousands and thousands of Hasidic Jews. When a woman gets married, she has to shave her head completely. I mean, completely bare-headed when she gets married. Now, my grandmother told us a story when I was a lot younger. My grandmother left Poland as a teenager, so she grew up in pre-World War I Poland. Of course, she's dead now, but my grandmother told us a story about a girl who refused to shave her head. She was about to get married, and she was very obstinate, you know, rebellious teenager. I imagine she was probably a teenager, and she refused to shave her head. So they, you know, one night, a bunch of people came, and I guess they somehow held her down and did it. You know, they got it done. They got the job done, you know. And, there are reasons for shaving the head. Now, when you see the religious women walking the streets of Williamsburg in Brooklyn, or Borough Park in Brooklyn, or Crown Heights, or maybe up in some of these other towns in upstate New York where you find them, but in Rockland County up that way and so on. It's funny, there's a town that I used to know, and the name's not coming to me, but it will in a moment, but it's not coming to me right now. But anyway, or Lakewood, New Jersey is another place you'll see them. But anyway, or Jerusalem, of course, you'll see the women will have scarves. Their heads will be covered with scarves. So you won't know that they don't have any hair because you'll just see the scarf covering the head and you'll think that under that scarf is hair. And I'm talking about married women. Now, on the other hand, for a special occasion, they'll wear a wig. And sometimes they'll wear a scarf over the wig, or sometimes they'll just wear the wig. So if you go to a wedding or a special occasion, you'll see a lot of women, and you'll say, doesn't she have beautiful hair? Well, it's a wig. It's not her own hair if she's married. So this is a very strong custom among Hasidic Jews, among Hasidic Jewish women. And I don't think it's anything that I don't know if they showed that on Stranger Among Us or not. If they had shown it, I don't think people would have been they found that very appealing. You know, as soon as a woman gets married, she has to shave her head. Now, they have reasons for that. They don't want her to be attractive to other men, all right? There was a time when that was more important in Eastern Europe when there was often a problem of possibly being raped by a Gentile. Perhaps they thought that being bareheaded would protect them from that. But nowadays, you'd think that they wouldn't have to go bareheaded. And then another issue has to do with the fact that once a month, a woman goes to a ritual bath and immerses herself after her period. And that, you know, that's a custom that there's biblical roots for that. But they go to a ritual bath and they, in effect, have a baptism every month after their period. But they want to have every inch of their body covered with that water. And so they want to even be bareheaded. Now that isn't really necessary. I mean, a lot of ultra-Orthodox Jewish women don't do that. It's a Hasidic practice. It's not universal. I mean, in my community, we wouldn't have done that. But they do it. And as I said, when they go to that ritual bath, therefore, they have their, that water is touching, I guess, every micro, little centimeter of their head. And some of the, I believe that they even scratch off scabs, which is not even healthy to do that. I don't know why they scratch off scabs before they do this ritual dunking. I don't know why the scab is an issue. Somehow, I guess the scab covers the real skin or something. I don't remember what the issue was there. But as I remember hearing about it, they would scratch off scabs before going down in there, which I don't, to me doesn't have a really seems a little bit. Let's say that it sounds a little bit extreme to me. So at least I'm ragging on my own people now because, I've lived among Hasidim. I love Hasidim. But I mean, these are the kinds of things that Jews growing up in that community knew about, and so they associated that with religion. You know, when they read the Old Testament, they would, they would read it colored by the interpretation that they saw. And I remember my grandfather, who was very well trained in religion, but he was a rather secular person. He, in effect, in a way, rebelled against it, as many Jews did in his day, as most Jews finally did in his day, frankly. My grandfather has also died by now, but my grandfather, again, was a product of pre-World War I Eastern Europe. He came out of Odessa on the Black Sea. He came to America 1 month before the First World War. And I remember going to a wedding. My uncle got married, and my uncle, of course, was his youngest son. And my uncle was a religious man, not like his father. My grandfather was secular, but my uncle was religious. And when my uncle got married, he had the wedding performed by Hasidic people. He had a Hasidic wedding, and so it was a lot of fun for me because I got to see a Hasidic wedding. Well, when my uncle was married back in 1962, it was a Hasidic wedding. Well, coming back from the wedding, my grandfather was, of course, being critical of the Hasidim because he didn't particularly like Hasidim. This may have been after the circumcision of my cousin. I don't exactly remember when it was, but one of these occasions where there were a lot of Hasidic Jews around and my grandfather didn't like them. So I defended them, of course. I was just a young punk at the time, a teenager, and I was defending the Hasidic Jews against my secular grandfather. And so my grandfather began talking about the dietary laws. And I said, well, grandfather, I wouldn't have said, however I put it, well, grandfather, the dietary laws are in the Bible. And then he said to me, very wisely, he said, well, more or less, what are you talking about? The Bible says you shall not see the kid in its mother's milk. And from this, they get all of these complicated laws, separate plates for meat, separate plates for milk, on and on you go. How many hours you have to wait between the time you have a meat meal and the time you have a dairy meal, and all these complicated dietary laws that have to do with meat and milk, just because it says don't cook a kid that's mother's milk. And, I wish he shut me up with that one, because he just quoted the Bible, and he said they took the Bible and they had all these complicated laws. And that is true. A lot of people don't understand that about kosher. There's biblically kosher, and there's rabbinically kosher. And rabbinically kosher has to do also with not mixing meat and milk together. And those laws can be very complex and can cause a lot of concern. I mean, when I was in the rabbinical school living with young men, you know how young men are when they live together. Not the best organized, neatest people necessarily. I mean, maybe some are going to be. In this show, The Odd Couple, there was one fellow who was very fastidious and one who was a real slob. So maybe you can get some of each kind. But imagine, we had to be careful in the rabbinical school to keep the milk fork separate from the dairy forks and the milk spoons separate from the dairy spoons and the milk pots separate from the dairy pots. And, guys coming and going all the time. You're going to get the occasional question. And my roommate who used the comb, who was one of the more devout, who was one of the more devout men in the place, one of the more serious students, he would get emotionally distraught over these issues about whether it's milk, meat, whether we mix the wrong pot or mix the wrong stuff. And sometimes he would just leave, go away for the Sabbath or something, or just walk away, because it just stressed him out, And so these are the kind of things. And I said, a Jew growing up in a religious household, this is their image of religion. So, as I said, these are the kinds of things that come up. And so, and God told His people to be, to certainly to be careful and to be zealous, but not to be peculiar in a wrong way. Now, you know, the word peculiar can be a positive thing if you're unique and special and so on, but peculiar meaning odd is not what He wanted. You know, it kind of reminds me of Deuteronomy 12. This is a... A separate issue, but it's kind of related. You know, I wanted to read that scripture where it said that, you know, God gave you His law and then He didn't add, you know, because, well, look at verse 32. There is a verse here that's similar, and it has it very directly. Deuteronomy 12:32. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it nor take away from it. You know, so people can add more than is necessary. Now, sometimes you do have to have legislation to protect the spirit of a law because people maybe are abusing it and running around it. But that can be taken to an extreme. And so just as you shouldn't take away from it, you shouldn't add to it. That's what it says here. Now, notice what else it says in verse 29. It says, when the Eternal your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise. You shall not worship the Eternal your God in that way. For every abomination to the Eternal which He hates, they have done to their gods, for they burn even their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. That's how far it goes. So he said, don't copy what the pagans are doing and try to absorb that into my religion. I don't want you to do that. And often that does happen, though. People who are in biblical religions find that they have absorbed into those biblical religion pagan customs that have very negative origins. Sometimes they're watered down. They're not observed in quite the same way as before. But they still are from that origin and are negative things that shouldn't be there and are irrelevant or even sidetracking you, distracting you from what's important. I'd like to now go to the book of 1 Kings. These are realities. Weird things are done in the name of religion. Now, I've been picking on so far Buddhism and Judaism. Let me talk a little bit about Islam. If we go to 1 Kings 18, you know, I'm sure that there's a lot of positive things one can say about Islam. And, you know, one thing that maybe you could say is about positive about Islam is that they limit a man to only four wives. And it's quite a positive, you know. You have to be able to care for each one equally. If you're going to have four, you have to be able to provide for each one of them equally. Not only that, you're supposed to have permission. If you want to take a second wife, the first wife is supposed to give you permission. Now, I'm saying all these things in a way tongue-in-cheek. Obviously, if you have a religion like that, if a man really wants to be polygamous, he's going to be polygamous. You think he's really going to not do it because the first wife didn't give him permission? I suppose it's possible. And is he going to really be able to care equally for four women? That seems to be a very difficult thing to really do in practice. Now, I haven't seen it that much in practice, so, you know, but it would seem awfully difficult to really do that properly. And is that really a proper environment in a society to have men, you know, men having four wives? I understand that in Old Testament times that was there, but you also see the complications that it led to. For example, the issues between Rachel and Leah, the issue between Sarah and Hagar, you know, and on it goes. With the problems of polygamy. And in traditional Muslim law, it's quite easy for a man to divorce his wife. I don't know if a wife can even divorce her husband. I'm not sure about that. But I believe a man... I read of a case in the newspaper. Now, maybe this is inaccurate. But when I was a child, I read of a case in the newspaper where a Muslim man sent his wife a tape. He wasn't even present, nor was, I think, anybody present, just whoever brought the tape to her. Maybe somebody was authorized to do it. Maybe it was some official. But the tape simply said to her officially, you know, I divorce thee. You know, I say thee because in Arabic there probably is a difference between, you know, like as in Hebrew, ata and atem, thou and ye. So I divorce thee three times. That's it. She's had it. She's gone. You know, and I don't know if she could ever remarry in that culture. I would think it'd be very difficult. But just by sending her a tape, when I divorce thee three times, you know, he can get rid of her. As I said, I think if you study Islamic culture with all the positive things you can say about it, I think you'll find the status of women in that culture, even in a progressive Islamic society, would let's say leave something to be desired. Put it that way. Another thing I'll say about Islamic culture again, not to pick on that, but I've picked on the others. You know, I'm having my rantings today. How punishments are meted out. As far as I understand, under strict Islamic law, if a person steals something, then his hand is he loses a hand. Well, you know, that maims him for the rest of his life. Okay, if you steal something, of course you should be punished, but to maim somebody for the rest of his life, how's he ever going to be a productive laborer if without two hands? You know, what kind of a thing is that? But as far as I understand, that's what strict Islamic law does. Now, fortunately, in Saudi Arabia, where I think that may still be the law, at least you can go to the hospital and have it done in a humane sort of way. But what would have happened in the year 750, let's say? That's terrifying to think about. Anyway, let's get back now to ancient times. And here we have worshippers of Baal. And these are religious people. And what was their custom as part of their religion? To cut themselves. Because somehow that was, that somehow would get their God's attention. Here's Elijah talking to the prophets of Baal. Now Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, this is verse 25 of 1 Kings 18, choose one bull for yourselves and prepare it first, for you are many, and call on the name of your God, but put no fire under it. So they took the bull which was given them, and they prepared it, and called on the name of Baal from morning even till noon, saying, O Baal, hear us. But there was no voice, no one answered. Then they leaped about the altar which they had made. Now what if you were not a person who was used to religion, and the first religious ceremony you saw, people were jumping around like that? You might think, what kind of thing is this? I wouldn't do this at a board meeting. I wouldn't even do this at a sports event necessarily. Maybe at some very, you know, intense time you might. But then, you know, you'd normally think of yourself as a little immature to do that. Verse 27. And so it was at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is meditating, or he is busy, or he is on a journey, or perhaps he is sleeping and must be awakened. So they cried aloud and cut themselves. Now you might think, well, this was an extreme time. They just did this out of hysteria because he was mocking them. No! Look at what it says. So they cried aloud and cut themselves, as was their custom, with knives and lances until the blood gushed out on them. Now, you think that just happened at the time of Elijah? No. People do that today. People do that to themselves as part of religious practice. Some people in Catholicism go on their knees to shrines, and on they crawl on their knees to these shrines on stone surfaces to where their knees are eventually going to bleed. And somehow I guess that makes them more spiritual. That's what they think. And some people try to crucify themselves in a way. They mutilate themselves in order to picture the crucifixion and so forth. Or some people miraculously bleed in certain parts of their body as if they're somehow imitating Christ and so on. These kinds of things happen, you know, in the world of religion. I'd like to go now to Matthew, the sixth chapter. Where Christ says in verse 7, and when you pray, do not use vain repetitions as the heathen do, for they think that they will be heard for their many words. Therefore, do not be like them, for your Father knows the things you have need of before you ask him. So yes, you can have repetition. You can sing a song and have a chorus. I mean, his mercy never fails. That's 26 times in Psalm 136. But there's you say something and then you answer. You say something and then you answer. It's like a chorus where you say something and then there's a repeating. But on the other hand, should you just take a paragraph and say it over and over and over and over? You know, what happens to your mind? What happens to you when you do that? Now, I can actually recite Hail Mary. How is that possible that I can say Hail Mary by heart? Because I used to hear it on the radio when I was a child in Fairfield, Connecticut. I turned on the radio, the Bridgeport, Connecticut station, and at the end of the day, they kept playing, you know, Hail Mary, Mother of God, the Lord is with you. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen. How can I recite that? I went to rabbinical school. I heard that on the radio over and over and over. How many times should that be repeated? And what's the point of that? You say it so many times, what does that do for you? 15, 20 times does this, or 55 times does that? I don't know. And again, I'm not down on Catholicism. You know, that's another thing I'm talking about. But as you get into the world of religion, you have this concept of repeating something over and over and over and over, and somehow that does something for you. You wouldn't want to do that in any other area of life. I'd like to go to 1 Timothy 4. 1 Timothy 4. Now let me go to the Protestants. You thought you were going to get away, huh? Now this 1 Timothy 4. Now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry. Well, you know, again, talking about Catholicism, they have had a celibate priesthood for centuries, and nobody can budge them from that. Now, why is it better for a priest to be celibate? Now, Paul does talk about it can be an advantage to be single. He brings that out. But the normal state is to be married under normal circumstances. But in the Catholic Church, the holy men are celibate. And as I mentioned before, that seems to be the case in the Orient as well. You know, holy men are celibate. I mean, even Jedi are supposed, you know, the Jedi Knights are to have to be celibate and so on. I'm joking. But the point is, you know, what is this here? Forbidding to marry a priest? I mean, how is he going to help other people if he doesn't have a family of his own? He can. I know. Some can. But normally, you're going to be more helpful to people if you have the same kind of life as they have in terms of the basics. You know, a wife, children, and so on. Forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. For every creature of God is good and nothing to be refused if it is received with thanksgiving, for it is sanctified by the word of God and prayer. Now, there are foods that God set aside for people to eat. So how dare somebody come along and then tell me I can't eat them? You know, that I, for example, I can't eat meat. How dare somebody forbid meat when God allows it? How dare they forbid alcohol when God allows it? Now, I understand that alcohol can be a problem, but, you know, eating too much can be a problem, too, and can lead to all kinds of diseases if you eat too much. And obviously, if you drink too much, that's a very serious problem. But, okay, that's moderation. But forbidding, as part of your religion, forbidding alcohol as part of your religion? Or forbidding meat as part of your religion? But this happens. Now, I'm not condemning somebody who's a vegetarian. I'm talking about religion. I'm not talking about a religion forbidding something that God allows. I'm not talking about your own personal tastes or concerns or issues that you may have. You know, I'm talking about religion that come along and tell you what to do. Where God allows you to do it, they forbid you to do it. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, you may be single and have your reasons for staying single. And Paul talks about staying single. I'm not condemning being single. I'm condemning the fact, as the Bible is. I'm just repeating it. The Bible is condemning religions that make you be single. That's the point. All right. I'd like to just now go to Ezekiel 36. And frankly, Protestantism gets into that, you know. They get into forbidding things like, as I said, use of alcohol, totally forbidding it, and certain other forms of entertainment that are really neither here nor there, but become issues. And not so much. That's not so much the case anymore. Those Puritan days are mostly gone. And in some ways, maybe we—I don't know how much we've benefited from the fact that they've gone. But anyway, in Ezekiel 36, I want to go to verse 22. I am running a little short on time, so let me just say this. Here, God intervenes for the Israelites, and He says, "Therefore, say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord Eternal: I do not do this for your sake, O house of Israel, but for my holy name's sake, which you have profaned among the nations wherever you went." And you can keep reading. The children of Israel, the very fact that they had to be put into exile was a desecration of God's name. It shouldn't have happened. They sinned, and therefore they were forced into exile. So where you had large Jewish minorities in different areas, that was an affront to God in a sense, because He had to send them there as a punishment. But not only that, in many cases when they were there, now not in every case, but in many cases, they didn't maintain the standards they should have maintained, and so they're doubly a bad example, because here they are, the people of the book, the chosen people, but they're not acting that way. And especially in recent years, that's been the case. In the last century, unfortunately, it's often been the case that the chosen people, you know, the people of the book, have not maintained proper standards. And so in that sense, God is defamed, because they're supposed to be an example. Now you could read that Ezekiel 36 at length, and I'm going to jump to Romans 2. So Ezekiel 36 could be read at length, but I'll now go to Romans 2. And Paul again criticizes the Jews here in that same way. He says, you know who you are, and you even take a certain pride in who you are. Well, if you're going to take pride in being Jewish, then live like a Jew ought to live. I mean, a lot of these Hollywood personalities probably do take pride in being Jewish, but their lifestyle, you know, has now become infamous around the world. Everybody around the world talks about the Hollywood lifestyle. Unfortunately, a lot of those involved in the Hollywood lifestyle are people who ought to know better. You know, their great-grandparents were Hasidim. Talk about, you know, a change. But anyway, here's what he says. Verse 25. I'm sorry, I'm going to go back to 23. You who make your boast in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, as it is written. So people see Jews misbehaving, and then they wind up thinking critically about God's law as a result, because of people falling short. Now, as I said, you know, Paul was criticizing his own people, and he had a right to, coming from within. And in the third chapter, he then says good things about them, too. If you keep reading, you know, he has very positive things about to say about the Jews, too. So we have to get a balance here, because there are many Jewish communities that over the years did set an example. And even then, you know, people resented the good example, and often they were persecuted for righteousness' sake. And that does happen. You can be persecuted for righteousness' sake out of envy. You know, so I'm not just wanting to turn on people, or certainly not to turn on my own people, but I'm just saying that very often religion can be a turnoff, and as I said, many Jews themselves were turned off by abuses they saw in their own religion. In America today, 90% of the Jews in America don't practice their religion the way their great-grandparents did. 90% of them don't. And I realize that a lot of it is their own reason, their own cop-out, and some of it is also the fact that it was so complex. And there were abuses and hypocrisies that they saw, and I don't have time to go into all of them today, but you all have examples in your own religious tradition of similar things that you have seen. And it can be a cop-out if you take it to just tune out religion entirely. But unfortunately, people who are involved in that have to face that culpability, that they made their religion, in effect, a turn-off unnecessarily by adding things, by complicating things, by going to extremes, by being unbalanced. You know, so the summary of my point today is that religion ought to be something that a practical-minded person can evaluate and can be affected by and can see value to. He may finally say, "Look, I'm too weak. I want to have my wine, women, and song, or whatever it is, in excess." You know, he may say, "I don't have the character to do it," but he at least ought to see it as something that it could be of use, of value. It kind of reminds me of a conversation I had with my advisor when I got my PhD. He was a very secular person. Of course, he had a lot of religious training. He was the head of the religion department, but he was a far-out liberal. But, you know, a very fine man as a person. And this man said to me, one of the heads of the religion department of USC, he said, "Reading your dissertation about your religion, it makes it almost palatable." Well, that's a great compliment coming from an ultra-liberal like him, but that's because I presented it in a practical way. I didn't present it in a bizarre way. You know, I didn't want to appeal to that side of him. I wanted to appeal to the practical side of him. So let's go to 2 Timothy, the first chapter. And I want to tell everybody who listens to this message, either you're listening now or you're listening later, that we are coming to the peak of secularism. It's not over yet. Secularism will peak maybe in the next few years, as even Iraq gets more secular, and maybe Iran has a revolution to throw out the Ayatollahs maybe and gets more secular. Secularism has not yet even peaked, but eventually it's going to peak, and we're going to have a reaction such as we've already begun to have in the Muslim world. We're going to have that, and eventually in Europe we're going to have a kind of return back to religion. And when it happens, it's not going to be a balanced, practical approach to religion. No, it's going to be the bizarre, the extreme, the crusader mentality. It's going to be the kind of religion that oppresses. Now, there's going to be good things, too. I suppose they'll clean up a lot of some of the immorality, although not to a great extent, not to the extent you might think, because if you look at the book of Revelation, it says that even at the very end, when Christ returns, a lot of people are going to be very immoral. So whatever they do will only be, I think, quite superficial in terms of immorality. But along with enforcement of some kind of standard of morality to finally break the anarchy that's descending upon the world, they're going to also come up with the extremes that you were already seeing in the Islamic world. You know, these kinds of extreme behaviors and persecution and oppression. So let's remember that religion is supposed to be a balanced, sound-minded, practical, useful, worthwhile thing. It's supposed to help us to get from point A to point B, and God does not designed it to be a blessing. God's religion is a blessing, and it is not a bizarre and weird and hurtful. Let's go to 2 Timothy, the first chapter, in verse 6. Therefore, I remind you to stir up the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands. Verse 7, for God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. God's religion is sound-minded.